This is Faux Real, a podcast where I chat with indie filmmakers about their filmmaking processes, their inspirations, and what their stories mean to them. And I'm your host, Dawn Borchardt. On this episode, I talk with filmmaker Emily Madavian, which you might know from Midnight Traveler. And this time she has made documentary Bitter Brush, which I saw premiere at the Telluride Film Festival in 2021. The film is now streaming on Hulu, and I highly recommend it. Give yourself some time and space to really get enveloped in this film. I hope you guys enjoy our conversation.
Hello, my name is Emily Madavian. I'm the director, producer, and one of the editors on the film Bitter Brush. And Bitter Brush is a portrait of one long summer over which two women are range riding in Idaho, totally off grid and contemplating their futures.
So I saw this film last year at Telluride in the most perfect space because it was outside at the Abel Gance Outdoor Theater and it was like freezing cold and in the mountains. And I remember being like, I just want to see the intro of this film and could not leave. Like, me and my boyfriend saw it and we loved it so much. So I'm so excited to get to talk to you today. It was my favorite film of the festival last year. So
that means you saw the very, very first public screening.
Oh, wow.
That was the first screening and that was our premiere festival.
I didn't even know that.
Also means you, so Coley, one of the women in the film, attended the festival with me.
Yep.
And that was the first time she saw the whole film.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do remember you guys being there for the Q&A and her coming up.
Yeah.
So that was awesome. I loved it. That was like the perfect place to see it. And I was like shivering and I was like, I'm not going to leave.
That's the spirit.
Yeah. I felt like I was like really relating to the film in that moment. It was perfect.
Yeah.
Just to sort of like get us into the interview and just kind of set the scene, can you talk about the title Bitter Brush and what that means for what that literally means and what that means for the film?
Yeah, bitter brush, which is one word, not two words, is a plant that is a common part of the, you know, native landscape here in the West, wherever you have the kind of brush, hillsides, you know, below the forest lands, you get sagebrush and you get particularly antelope bitter brush and grasses and all kinds of beautiful native flowers and cacti and stuff. And so I wanted a title that felt like it was really specifically of that land. And so I picked Bitterbrush. I thought there was something about the word that felt right.
Its resiliency really matches the characters in your film very well. I really like it.
Everything that lives in that landscape has to be so resilient because it is, it's dry, it's cold, you know. So like everything that's up there is this like remarkable adapted plant or animal for that environment. And in a way, including Holland and Coley, the two women in my film.
Totally. How did you meet these women and get involved in this story? We just found out, so I live in Salt Lake City. Turns out you live in literally down the street from me in Salt Lake City. So we're both out in the West. But how did you meet these women and get involved in this?
So before I moved here to Salt Lake City to take a job at the U, I was living there. I was living with my husband off-grid in a cabin over in the mountains in Idaho. And there's a sort of, I don't know what they would call it. It's not the main cabin you see in the film. It's the place you see them leaving from at the beginning. It's a house that belongs to the ranch, and it's where all the cattle are kind of sent out from and come back to. And that is about a mile and a half from our cabin. So a mile and a half out there means they were one of my closest neighbors. And so Holland was at dinner at one of my neighbor's houses. And I'd never met her before. And she's like hilarious. She's wearing these amazing handmade like leather blue and just incredible chaps. It was just like, who is this person cracking jokes about like eating beans out of a can without even heating them up or heating them up on the dash of her truck, you know? And then at the end of the day, like just by leaving them in the sun and then at the end of the day, like cracking a can opener. And I was like, this person is an incredible character. Like, where did she come from? And then I was just finishing Midnight Traveler, like releasing it. And I was like, I really want to make something where I'm working with women. I'd like to make something that's a lot closer to home for me now, at least. And then my husband was like, what about that woman? What about Holland? So I reached back out to her and I did some test shooting with her and talked to her more. And she eventually brought Coley down for the season, which was, of course, it was not my casting. That was her choice of her friend. But she was an incredible addition to the film, to the story of the film. And I was incredibly grateful that they both said yes.
What were you doing living out there? That's such like a very intentional place to be.
It is and it isn't. I mean, it's the kind of place that if you grew up there, of course you'd live there. I didn't grow up there. So it does seem odd that we were living there. My husband and I had been living in the Bay Area. I was finishing my PhD. He was working as a teacher. We were both trying to have our art careers on the side. We were like, we're never going to be able to afford a home here. And we went on a spur of the moment vacation to a farm stay kind of thing out there. And we were like, this place is gorgeous. And then we saw what the land cost and we were like, whoa, we can buy that. And so then we just bought some land and then we built a little tiny off-grid cabin.
Wow.
And then once we'd done that, we were like, let's get out of here for a while. And so we went there mainly as a way of just kind of buying back the time to devote to focusing on our artistic lives. And in the end, I think it paid off because we both found some success and also I think found a lot of like life lessons and meaning out of our time there, which is part of what I translated into Bitterbrush or a lot of what I was trying to say through the film.
Yeah, that's so cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, I do want to talk a little bit later about some of those like more introspective, meaningful bits. But before we get into that, I'm kind of curious and to more coordination standpoint, like what it was like filming with these women when they are on horseback and like in very remote places. Like what was that like for the cinematographer and for you to like literally even talk back and forth or like what was shooting that like?
Yeah, the biggest challenge by far of making the film was just figuring out how to follow them because they're covering so much ground on horseback and it's not land that you can traverse in a car. Like it's the only way there is on a horse, on foot, or in some cases you can get close on an ATV or you can get so far on an ATV and then you got to switch to on foot. So some of the stuff we got by like a combination of ATV plus hiking, and some of the stuff we rode with them. So the part of it is that the first half of the season, I was very pregnant. And the second half of the season, I had a tiny baby. So while I was very pregnant, I wasn't willing to get on a horse. So I did a lot of running up and down the mountains very pregnant rather than riding up and down the mountains. And then in the second half, I had a tiny baby. And I brought Derek out, who was a DP who had more horse riding experience. And so a lot of the scenes you see where people sometimes think it's drones, it's not drones. There's no drones in the film. It's actually Derek on a horse holding the camera in one hand and holding the reins in the other.
Wow, I absolutely thought those were drone shots. So
No drones. I outlawed drones from the film. I felt like the drones are drones give a very mechanical point of view most of the time. Mm-hmm. They're great for certain types of things, but they weren't the feel that I wanted. I wanted to feel like we were with them and riding with them. So that's how we did it.
Wow. I love that. That's so cool. Man, how do you find a DP that you're like, I need horseback riding experience?
You just keep asking around and then you'd be surprised. There are some DPs out there who are like horse nuts / DPs.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So these two women who are, you know, the main characters of your film, Holland and Coley, they're young women, but they are like old souls and have so much resilience and are so tough. What connections did you find that you had with them on like a deeper level? Like, what did you see in them that, you know, spoke to you and spoke to you of yourself?
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, the sort of most obvious first layer was just we all felt some connection to the land, some feeling that like this particular landscape in that moment was really feeding something to us. You know, they were working that land. I'd been living there and found that the experience of living that close to the land and living just a very different rhythm of life, sort of, you know, making a fire in the morning and then making my coffee, like in a sense, doing things that take extra time, but then slow you down, that, you know, where you have to go chop your wood, you know, in the morning if you were too lazy to have enough prepared. Actually, I found really transformative and rewarding in certain ways. And that same experience, that same kind of like lived wisdom from growing up on ranches and then working on this land. So that was one obvious thing. And I wanted to kind of explore that. I find like in film, it's often really difficult to deal with landscapes. You know, like our whole understanding of story structure is so human focused that, you know, the sort of challenge that I was interested in as an artist was how can I replicate my experience of the way the land is transformative of me that I saw they also felt. So that was one part. And then I think as I got to know them better and we hung out and we talked, you know, I didn't want to make a kind of look, women can do this too ranching story, because I just find those kinds of things like kind of condescending and pedantic, you know, frankly.
Yeah, so, it can be a little base level.
Yeah, it was like very base level. But it's also kind of, it's, you know, it's, there is a lot of sexism in that culture, right? I'm not saying there's not a lot of sexism, but there's also a long history of women in ranching. So it's like that just isn't even accurate to their experience, right? So I didn't want to do that. But I did want to think about how being women affects the choices you make or the opportunities that you have in this industry. And it was like really funny because when I was in my 20s, I worked in Hollywood and I like worked my way up slowly. And talking to them about their experience being the only woman on a ranch night calving with a bunch of dudes, I was like, oh, that sounds a lot like being the only woman on a set, you know, other than like the script supervisor with a bunch of dudes. And a lot of what they were experiencing that they weren't able to necessarily name was exactly the same kind of sexism that I had experienced. And so we became kind of allies of each other in that way, where it was like, no, I see what you're going through there. I'm also not going to make this a film about that drama, because that's not like who we wake up in the morning and see in the mirror. But I get it, you know, and it was nice just privately to validate that and then make something that spoke from the position of who we feel we are first and foremost, which has nothing to do with being discriminated against. It has to do with loving something, doing it because you feel compelled to and driven to against all odds, you know, all those kinds of things, which, again, indie filmmaking and like ranching in the 21st century as, you know, a person who doesn't own a ranch, like both kind of like stupid long odds, right? So.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of ways that we were like, oh yeah, that's the same thing that I have in my life.
You made me think about how Holland like, couldn't remember Marilyn Monroe's name. And she's like the epitome of like hyper femininity in the film world. And there's like that disconnect and it's kind of...
She's like the blonde one. Yeah. Like, yeah.
And I like that.
Yeah.
You talk about all of your connections to the land. And I'm curious, since you said you weren't born in that area, like what your connection was to land growing up and like how that's transformed, especially in making this film.
So I was born outside Seattle before Seattle got big. So when I was a young kid, I was able to just kind of run around outside a lot, but I wasn't brought up like on a ranch or anything, you know. And then in my teen years and my early adult years, I lived like in or very close to major cities. And I found that when we moved there, it was just, it was a mixture of feeling a kind of return to that desire to have a chance to be close to nature, but also was... the first time I ever lived in a ranching community like that, lived in a community where, you know, pretty much all of the economics have to do with the way that you relate to the land. And that has a really interesting effect on all kinds of elements of, you know, social structures and things like that.
You're living in Salt Lake City now. Have you like and you're working at a university. Has that changed the way that you live here? Or like why you chose Salt Lake or like
oh what yeah, you do I applied on the weekends, to the job. Or... Yeah, yeah. No, I applied to the job in Salt Lake City because, you know, it was the closest major university. You know, it's like 4.5 hours from here to there, which tells you how remote that area is because there was no major city closer than 4 hours. And by major, I'm counting like things with a population of like, you know, over 80,000, like, you know, not necessarily a big city. So it was pretty remote. And I thought, oh, I can stay kind of close to that at this job and have, you know, health insurance for my child. Yeah. Right? Because those are the kinds of things that, you know, like those very practical nuts and bolts things. Like I was pregnant and going to have a kid and I wanted to give her a degree of stability. It was really similar to what Holland ends up then facing, right? It's like, I'm having a kid. I guess I can't live like in a trailer with no heat, you know, like I need to change my life to accommodate this person. And so, you know, I mean, I had a PhD, certainly I was like prepared for academia, but part of the motivation was also the idea of the kind of providing stability for my daughter.
Yeah.
Health insurance, you know?
Yeah. That was, you actually answered my two next questions all in one. I knew that you were a mother and like Holland becoming or going to become a mother is such like a central part of the film's structure. And so I was curious to talk about like how that's informed. Maybe I could ask how it's informed your work now, because like you talk about practical things, but I imagine that that has to change everything or impact or inform everything that you do.
It does. I think the thing that, you know, I think there's a generation that sort of said you can have it all. And then there was this, you know, realization that, well, you know, in a society where I don't have access to maternity leave and my spouse doesn't have access to paternity leave and we don't have access to health insurance that we can afford. Having it all doesn't, it's just not how it works, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, you have to make choices. And yet, you know, there isn't a contradiction in saying, I love my daughter so much and I want to provide all these things for her and I'm glad I'm her mother. And saying, I also am not willing to sacrifice my career. I love making films. I love doing this work. And for instance, in 5 weeks, I'm going to get on an airplane and then another airplane and then another and another and another. And I'm going to go to an extremely remote ice sheet in Antarctica and shoot film for a couple months. And I'm going to be desperately missing my daughter, but I'm going to do it, you know, and I can do it because I have a supportive spouse. And so it's a kind of interesting era that I think many of us are in where we're kind of trying to do both and recognizing that there are these very hard trade-offs that are intrinsic in that. And, you know, in Holland's case, she had her daughter Flossie, and at 4 or 5 weeks old, she strapped Flossie to her chest. She got on a horse.
Oh my gosh.
You know?
I would expect and like, nothing less, but that's so cute.
And then, you know, Flossie was 2 years old and she was like riding the pony, you know? I mean, so it's like, to some extent, you say, I'm going to find a way to make this work. But also, like, I don't want that to sound like I'm saying it's super easy. It's not easy. It's a really hard thing to try to balance. It's like the major life challenge, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think, like, what Holland faces in that crossroads that we first see is, like, almost, there's almost that naiveness that I recognize that I had, where like I was running all over the mountain at 8 months pregnant, like, yeah, I can just keep doing everything. And then you have the kid and you're like, oh boy, you know, I can't just like leave her somewhere. Like, you know, she needs a caretaker. So how do we make this work?
I love that you're going into the Arctic. It's like extreme landscapes. It's great.
Yeah, I know. I was joking. I'm going to Antarctica with a group of almost all women scientists.
Oh, amazing.
It's like I make, at least for now, apparently, films about women at work in very cold climates.
I love it.
I'm just getting colder and colder.
So one of the things that I really loved about this film and made me think about like some of my favorite moments throughout my life is that Holland and Coley are like you said, slowing down. There's like these beautiful shots of like the sweeping landscapes and the night sky and them sitting next to a fire. And in these like really slow, quiet moments, they're incredibly introspective. And like those are moments that I love to have, whether that's like camping or like being with my family and having like all sitting around a bonfire and having like telling fun stories, but having like introspective moments with each other or just with yourself. And so I'm wondering, like while you were shooting this with them, as they're thinking about their life, was that inspiring you to have introspective thoughts yourself? And like, what was that like? And would you like kind of maybe your mind would wander elsewhere and be like, oh, let me think about my own trajectory or like reflection on my mother? Or
I mean, when I'm filming, my mind doesn't wander. mean, particularly if I'm the one behind the camera, I'm very focused on whatever's going on. But certainly, I think that feeling of the rhythm of that type of life and how it facilitates that introspection, and also in their case, the friendship. You know, just the closeness of the two women. And that kind of like the really special thing that is being in this space where there aren't any men, when normally there are only men around them. So you have the two of them able to just be themselves with each other and be goofy and silly and also be introspective and serious. Like that stuff was something I really wanted to capture. And so that's why there are those moments that are really like, they're not just like pictures of the landscape, I hope. You know, I hope that what they are is they're a moment where we feel that kind of slowing down and we feel the looking around and the effect that has on your body as somebody who's living out there, and then how that translates to just the kind of letting go, either into reminiscing about your mother or laughing over about something silly, or, you know, or saying something more honest than you do, you know, that just the kind of quiet that leads to an honesty. That's what I wanted those shots to be for. And that was something I planned really from the outset. I mean, I really kind of didn't have a lot of funds to make the film, so I didn't have very many shoot days. So a lot was planned in advance. You know, obviously not the things that are spontaneous conversations, but certainly the notion that it was going to be one season and that I wanted to make sure I got there to see the place in the different seasons, to see the place at different times of day, to see them at different moments in their work, and also, frankly, not follow them every day because I'd be in the way if I did that. You know, so I was pretty careful about how much I was filming with them. And I think in many ways, the success of that then had to do with them being comfortable enough to just be themselves in those moments when I was actually filming. There were times I just hung out with them and I wasn't filming, which helped as well.
Yeah, I think that the pace of the film really sets like a really good tempo of like enveloping you and making you feel like you're at the same pace as them in a lot of ways. And it's not a pace that we feel every day.
It's not. And it's kind of a big ask, you know, but I also just find myself now, I don't know if it's having a kid, pandemic, every, you know, new jobs, all the stuff, but it's been a time in which, you know, maybe some people have felt very isolated probably during the pandemic, but a lot of us have felt things just kind of ratchet up and you have more and more lack of attention even and disconnection, you know? So for me, it felt really important to find ways to kind of to slow down and to reconnect to the things that really mm-hmm. matter. So I feel okay about asking an audience, like, take a moment to just take that inhale with yeah. me before these women, you know, take the exhale of sharing something really momentous.
I love that. And I'm grateful for it. I was I was there. I'm in it. I needed it. So just to start to wrap things up, I'm curious how making this film has impacted the way that you see the world or society, and specifically this notion of freedom.
Like, oh, the overly fetishized notion of freedom. Yes. I mean, it's like a dangerous word, you know, because it's become a yes. politicized word. And
oh, it sure has.
Certainly to the degree that any notion of freedom exists in my film, it's not a politicized version of freedom, right? It's a version of freedom that has to do with space and time, right? Having the space and time to let yourself let go of things, to let yourself refocus. And, you know, in tension with that, all through the film, are all of the ways that the two women lack freedom, you know, which have to do with the economics of their job and their relationships with their families and their bosses and all the people in their lives that don't facilitate, you know, their road to where they hope to be. So, you know, I think the tension there is that you love something and you feel it's worthwhile and you want to live a certain way. And yet it's not easy because not just that the work is hard, but that the kind of social conditions framing the work are not designed to make it easy for you. And I think that's something that so many of us experience. You know, and top it all off, they're basically gig workers. I mean, it's actually a very 21st century situation that they're in, because they're basically like, you know, any Uber driver, those are their horses. Those are their dogs. They buy the food, you know, like they have a lot of overhead and they're not very well paid. So you think like, well, why are they there? And then it comes back down to that something that, you know, almost the notion of freedom doesn't quite encapsulate, because it's something very deep and very kind of primal about a feeling of purpose in life. And for both of them, this is purpose. So they push forward. I find that really interesting, and it resonates with me as a filmmaker.
Yeah, absolutely. It is definitely looking at, it's like a microcosm of so many things that are going on, but in a much like slower, easier way, an introspective way, I think, to think about and look at things.
Yeah. I mean, I think the film itself like points to a lot of hardship without, I hope, without exploiting the women's right. lives, or without like, you know, I don't want to make entertainment out of their hardship. To the extent that we take pleasure from the film, I hope we take pleasure from the same things they take pleasure from, you know, yeah. the landscapes and the rest of it. And that the other can just be a slow realization that there are some real sort of like issues here that are a microcosm of issues many of the rest of us may recognize.
Yeah. Well, we have this like romanticism about probably what that lifestyle is like. And not that yeah. it doesn't reflect that in a lot of ways, because it does. But there's definitely a lot of other elements and like underlying things that you show in this film. So
thank you. I'm glad if they came through.
Yes. Well, that's all I had. So I guess just lastly, where can people watch this beautiful film and follow you?
Well, right now it's on VOD, and in about 1 or 2 weeks, it'll pop up on Hulu. Streaming, yay! And if people want to follow me, I guess they're going to have to put my name in their Google alerts or something, because I'm not on any social media, I suppose. Big surprise after everything I just said. But I will have another film coming out hopefully soon. So, you know, they can watch for that in a few years. And I'll see them down the road.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today. I cannot believe you're a couple blocks away from me. And
I know, I was going to say, I'll see you at the Copper Common outside the Broadway for an indie film sometime in the near future.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a regular.
Awesome.
Just went
all
like
right.
2 weeks ago. So.
No, seriously, I will send you an invite. I walk there all the time.
Oh, yes, I just saw Nosferatu with a live score and went
there,
had a drink beforehand.
See, it's the way to go. It's an advertisement for everyone to come to Salt Lake City, indie film capital of the world that they didn't know about. Ha yeah. ha.
It's a beautiful place.
After living in remote Idaho, where the closest theater was one that my husband and I helped reopen because we were desperate for indie films, it's incredible to have an indie theater two blocks away. And
oh, it's so nice.
The pandemic was such a reminder that, you know, like, I didn't just make my film to be seen large. I also, like, do this because there's something about seeing things together, the communal experience of it. And so it's been so nice to be able to go back and watch movies with
so
people
nice.
And
I
hear
love
them
it.
Laugh.
It's all I want. It's all I want yeah. in life.
Awesome.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Like I said in the beginning, Bitter Brush is now streaming on Hulu, so you can go check it out. I hope that you really enjoy all of those Western landscapes and the women's subtle yet powerful stories. The music is Lost and Bound by Talleen Kelly. The podcast artwork is by Whitney Salgado. And I'm your host, Dawn Borchardt. Thank you for listening. And as always, thank you for supporting the podcast. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please be sure to rate and review so we can pop up on more people's feeds so more people can listen to the podcast. Thank you so much.